Welcome back to another episode of Palisade Radio. This is host Colin Cattell, and today on the show is returning guest Rick Rule, Senior Managing Director at Sprott Inc., President and CEO of Sprott U.S. Holdings. Rick, I last saw or spoke to you, I believe it was in September of 2019 in Carlsbad, and I think it was fair to say at the time, with gold prices moving up, that you were cautiously optimistic. And fast forward 6 months, wow, how things can change in the market landscape. How does Rick Rule, the gold junior resource speculator and investor, feel at this moment about how things are going?
Well, certainly, as you suggest, a lot of things have changed. And our business has gone from improving to white hot. The truth is, and we'll get into the timing in a minute, that the enthusiasm that gold has seen hasn't trickled down to the juniors yet, which makes perfect sense. We have seen 8 prior recoveries from oversold bottoms in the last 45 years, and they follow very predictable patterns. Gold moves, then 6 or 9 months later, the senior stocks move. Then, you know, sort of the rest begin to move, and finally the juniors move. Certainly, we are seeing more liquidity among the better juniors, but right now the most crowded parts of the trade are physical gold and the best of the best gold seniors, exactly what you would anticipate in a market like this.
Rick, you've seen more bull markets than most. You've seen them play out. There is a very noticeable trickle-down effect, as you just pointed out. It seems, at least to many investors, that the trickle-down effect maybe was a bit more prolonged this time around. But what I've noticed is, as you just pointed out, this recent move after the epic sell-off a few weeks ago does seem to be carrying the juniors with it finally. So what do you think that means? What's going to play out over the next few months with that junior part of the market pulling up with the rest?
Well, you know, the best of the best juniors just got oversold. So it makes sense that they would pop up on an absence of selling, even without buying, which is what happened. What you're going to see in the next 6 months is that the juniors have played just in time. They played chicken with capital markets. And the first thing that will happen is that any juniors that see any shows of strength in the market will dampen that show of strength by raising money. So you certainly aren't going to see the junior indexes move, because the best companies in the sector that move the index the most will use early buying to get financings off to put themselves in shape to go further next year. The second thing is that the gold trade, the gold equities trade, to be sure, is still attracting people to the biggest, highest quality and most liquid names. Even the gold bugs got punished so severely in the market decline that we've just lived through, the 7 or 8 year market decline, that their moves back into the sector, while enthusiastic, are still cautious. And they're going into the biggest and the best names. That's happened every single move in my career in the business. It's not surprising. So I would tell your listeners and readers, the more sophisticated ones, get yourself positioned now, but don't be expecting any moonshots in the near term. That's not the kind of market that we're at in an early recovery.
Rick, we've harped on it so many times before, but there are new listeners, and it's so important. The all-important private placements and the warrants. I know this is how you've had just tremendous success and gains in the past when bull markets do finally come. Maybe just a brief overview of the importance, if you are in the position to participate directly in financing companies.
Sure. If your listeners are accredited, which is basically to say, there are caveats, but basically to say, if you have a portfolio with a value of over $1 million and you are willing to take the risk inherent in participating in juniors, the best way to play the game is via private placements. Private placements are private, not on-market issuances of equity. They come to trade later, but you're not buying your stock over the exchange from a different investor. Rather, you're buying newly issued shares, or hopefully newly issued shares and warrants, directly from the company. The downside, of course, associated with this is that, at least for Americans, very often you get restricted shares, which is to say that you can't sell them immediately. And if something goes wrong with the company, you are stuck. The advantage of private placements is that you can buy relatively large positions at negotiated prices without moving the market. But the biggest advantage is, of course, the warrant. a warrant is a right, but not the obligation to buy more stock for a fixed period of time at a fixed price. Because the nature of exploration speculation really involves answering unanswered questions, primarily with the drill bit, the ability to take advantage of the answering of an unanswered question twice, once with the stock you bought, and then secondly with a warrant, becomes an extraordinary advantage. People say, you know, in the last 6 or 7 years, private placements haven't made people much money, which is true. The TSXV resource index declined almost 90% in real terms. So stocks that go up, don't go up, seldom reward warrant holders. There have been several periods in my career where the warrants have been absolutely, positively invaluable. On several occasions, I've had warrants that exercised at 30 cents or 50 cents in a market where the news flow subsequent to the placement was good, and the stocks were selling at $3 or $3.50. Having a $3.50 bid at the same time that you have a 35-cent warrant is pretty close to heaven.
For someone like yourself who's seen many cycles and this is your business, you probably have a pretty good feeling about what you think is to come. But there's a lot of sentiment, even though it's shifting to the positive, let's say, that is used to the past 10 years, which has essentially been a bear market since 2011 for juniors. And the only glimmer of hope in that time that they saw was a 7-month bull market in 2016. So not only are people scared to begin with, but they think that if we do have a move, it might only last 6 or 7 months. Is it fair to say that there is a lack of exploration dollars and that needs to be cured by money actually going into the space and staying in the space for a sustained enough time to actually have discoveries?
There is a shortage of money that is going into the exploration space. In fact, I would argue that as an industry, we have underinvested in exploration for 10 years and we have mis or malinvested for 30 years. So what you say is certainly true. That notwithstanding, interest will return to the junior and the exploration sector simply because the prices that will be paid for successful discoveries by reserve-starved majors will be astronomical. When I think about this question, I think about two things. One, companies that deserve to go up because they made discoveries, and those are fairly scarce. But also to remember that a rising tide floats all ships. When I'm asked about the resurgence from oversold periods with regards to the juniors, I finally found a good way to answer that question. Later on in this interview, I'm going to give you a link for your listeners to respond. And any listener that does respond, I will send them a copy of the Barron's Gold Mining Index chart. I use the Barron's index because it's a very broad-ranging index. It's not a constrained index, and it's the longest index that I can find. And when you are considering the way that you began this question, which is a discussion of cyclicality, having a visual like this chart is really fantastic. The chart teaches you a couple things. The first is that the long bear market that you refer to, sort of 2011 to 2019, when you look at the chart over other oversold bottoms in the last 45 years, what you learn is that this one was both very deep and very long. And the chart suggests that we're approaching the bottom at the bottom, or much more likely just off the bottom of a bear market that was one for the record books. The second thing that the chart shows you is that there have been over 45 years, 8 recoveries from oversold bottoms. And the dimension of the recoveries are very, very, very instructive about why you play this game. My old eyes showed me that the worst of the recoveries generated about 180% index return. That's not picking the best stock in the index. That's the return of the whole index. While the best recovery generated a 1,200% return. And these returns occurred over periods of time that were as brief as 12 or 13 months or as long as 42 months. So it's important to remember in the junior space that gold moves first, then the big gold stocks, then the juniors. It's also important to know, and this chart is evidence, that we have been through a bear market that has been one for the record books, both in terms of severity and in terms of its age. And we also see, with particular emphasis, I think, in the later cycle, to the money that is likely to flow into the junior sector after it has flowed into first bullion and then the seniors. The chart, and by the way, you know this, Colin, your readers don't. I'm no technical analyst. I'm not giving people this chart to get a sense of double tops or rounded bottoms or breakouts or anything. I'm just using it as an illustrative tool to show people where this gold equities market is in historic terms.
Rick, looking at the length and the depth of that bear market, and on the flip side of that, how much the, say, Dow Jones and S&P had consistently gone up year after year, one could make the argument that something was going to come along and flip that dynamic, and that eventually we were poised for gold to flip back and start to go back up. But let's just harp a second on what's actually happening right now. For me, this virus situation and everything being shut down, it almost feels like gold's the only place to invest right now. And I never imagined that that dynamic could happen. That is to say that the case for gold, because of what's actually tripped this off, makes me think that this could be bigger in terms of a bull market than I would have imagined. Would you kind of mirror that?
I think you can temper your enthusiasm and still be enthusiastic. I certainly agree with your main thesis. The incredible escalation that we've seen in the Dow, punctuated, of course, by a couple of dramatic downturns, really goes back to 1982 and a market that's in sort of continued uptrend from 1982 to 2020 is certainly a bull market that's long of tooth. You will note that that was accompanied by an incredible bull market in bonds, which were themselves a consequence of interest rates, which were artificially manipulated lower. It's difficult to go too much below zero. So in terms of the ability to artificially manipulate interest rates lower and send the stock market higher, that becomes challenged. But let's get away from the Dow and to gold and, by extension, gold stocks. In my experience, Colin, many things move the price of gold, but the most important dynamic is investors and savers' faith in the ongoing purchasing power of their savings in fiat currencies, but in particular in the U.S. dollar. And the U.S. dollar as expressed by U.S. Treasury securities. And this is why I think the gold trade is really going to gain strength. It is true that the U.S. dollar is the strongest currency in the world, as Doug Casey might say, the prettiest mare at the slaughterhouse, not to denigrate the dollar. But if you think about faith in the dollar, and in particular faith in U.S. sovereign or U.S. government debt, there's three things that you have to consider. The first is quantitative easing, which you and I have described as counterfeiting. Printing trillions of dollars worth of currency units out of thin air with no backing obviously debases the currency. That's very clear. And people are beginning to be concerned about the 2 or 3 year out impact of debasing the currency. But the fears go beyond that. The federal government balance sheet, which is in effect the credit behind the treasuries, continues to deteriorate. $23 trillion in on-balance sheet liabilities, or $17 trillion net of the expanded balance sheet of the treasury, with off-balance sheet liabilities, which is to say entitlements and things like that, political promises, having a net present value, according to the Congressional Budget Office, of $100 trillion, which means just at the federal level, we owe, as a people, $120 trillion. That's before state debt, before local debt, and before unfunded pension liabilities. Now, against that debit, you have to look at our ability to service that debt. And that debt is serviced by the national income, which is to say taxes and fees, less expenses. The problem is that our budget, the federal budget, which is how we service the debt, is in deficit, meaning that rather than paying down that $120 trillion in liability, we're adding to it between $1.5 and $2 trillion a year. Obviously, this is a circumstance where the debt is unsustainable. And given that people who own treasuries are part of that debt that is serviced by an increasingly bad credit, need to be concerned about the ongoing, you know, liabilities that they have associated with that sort of thing. It just becomes more and more difficult. The third part of the equation, the gold equation with regards to other savings products, is negative interest rates. Interest is the premium that you get paid for taking the risk, the time value of money, and the return. The truth is, when gold was doing very, very poorly, there were strong real rates of return in U.S. treasuries. That is, the people who put money on deposit got more money back than they put up. The current circumstance where the U.S. 10-year treasury, which is the world's benchmark security, yields 60 basis points in a currency that the Congressional Budget Office says is debased by 1.6% a year, means that if you buy a U.S. 10-year treasury, you will lose 1% a year compounded over 10 years. My friend Jim Grant calls this return-free risk. So I would argue with you that the gold price move is a consequence of return-free risk, which is to say no reward, a deteriorating balance sheet, and the simultaneous debasement of the currency. I'm not saying it's absolutely positively certain that precious metals prices go up. I'm just suggesting the probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side, particularly from a historical and arithmetic perspective.
So in light of the Ponzi schemes that you just outlined, let's talk about where gold could go. And I know you're not one to fall in the trap of actually putting a price target on gold. That's not what I'm asking. But I've had multiple discussions with people where I've said, you know, gold could go to 3,000, it could go to 5, it could go higher. And up until recently, they'll say you're crazy, but they forget that gold at one point was $35 an ounce. As recently as 2001, it was 250 and ran about 8 times to almost 2,000. Why is it so hard for people to wrap their head around the fact that gold could go up a couple multiples from where it is now?
I think, first of all, that people's expectation of the future is set by their experience in the immediate past. And their memory of the immediate past is the last decade, where gold fell from a high of 1900 down to sort of 1100. So the expectation of the future is set by the experience in the immediate rather than the long-term past. Many people simply aren't familiar with gold. It has been fully 40 years since gold was a popular investment. And people lose sight of the upside in gold. You have correctly, I think, pointed out that when gold moves, it generally really, really, really moves. In the decade 2000 to 2010, as an example, you pointed out that the gold price moved from, I think it was $250, $252, if my memory serves me correctly, to almost $1,900. So the circumstance that confronted us in 2000, 2001, 2002 was, I suggest, less dangerous for the broad economy than the circumstance that confronts us now. Certainly the policy response to the tech wreck in 2000 was increased liquidity, quantitative easing, which is to say counterfeiting and artificially low interest rates. But there were two critical differences between then and now. First of all, the economy itself was stronger. There were real interest rates to lower from, and we hadn't already fired so many bullets with regards to quantitative easing and borrowing. Now I think the circumstance is more grim, and the policy response will be more aggressive, which is to say that the damage that will be done to U.S. dollar-denominated savings instruments will likely be greater, and we will get less economic response from the policy response. How far can you cut interest rates below zero? So for all of those reasons, you'll notice that I studiously avoided giving you a gold price forecast. But when people say to me, how could gold possibly go through $3,000? I just ask them to look at the arithmetic and look at the arithmetic in the context of past moves in gold, which have been substantially more dramatic.
All right, Rick, let's shuffle through a couple final things before I let you go. Let's talk about what's happening in oil today. And most people know you, at least on this channel, with your affiliation to gold, but you actually know the oil market quite well. Oil is down to $2 a barrel today.
Yeah, I came up in the oil and gas business, and I never in my wildest dreams thought we'd see pricing like this. But obviously, you have a circumstance where the market gets flooded with production, partially, by the way, as a function of artificially low interest rates, at least in the United States, at the same time that demand falls away dramatically. When you run out of storage capacity, which we effectively have in the United States, you almost have to pay people to take it. And that's what happened. I'm not saying that the opportunity is necessarily immediately upon us. But the truth is, Colin, on a global basis, the fully loaded cost to produce a barrel of oil, and when I say fully loaded, I include cost of capital, exploration expense, general and administrative expense, tax, prior year write-downs. The fully loaded cost worldwide is estimated to be between $50 and $60 a barrel. If your listeners believe that 5 years from now, hell, 3 years from now, they'll be able to go out in the garage, turn the key to the right, and have the car start, they believe in much higher oil prices. When? I can't tell you, because this oversupply is chronic and this economy is very, very weak. But we will see a rip your face off rally in oil and oil stocks at some period of time. Electric vehicles notwithstanding. If you look on the road today and see how many Teslas there are relative to how many Toyotas and how many Hondas, you understand the arithmetic of the recovery.
Rick, a bit of trivia. We asked on Twitter if listeners wanted to hear about gold, silver, or uranium from you. Can you take a guess at which one they picked?
Oh, I would be delighted if they said uranium.
Well, they certainly did. What can you tell us about uranium?
The comment oddly sort of follows the oil narrative. It is too early to return for most people to the uranium sector. The price of uranium in the near term will be dictated, as it has been for 3 years, by the pace of the Japanese nuclear reactor fleet. It is true, as some of the bulls point out, that we're now using more uranium than we did before the Fukushima meltdown as a consequence of new plant construction. But the overhang is largely Japanese supplies. And the Japanese need to restart is constrained by two things. First, a decline in general economic activity worldwide, which leads to a decline in demand for Japanese exports, which leads to a decline in demand for electricity in Japan. The second is the extraordinarily low price of liquefied natural gas, which is what the Japanese have used as a generating medium to idle their nuclear fleet. Now, looking further out, the same circumstance that we described for oil exists for uranium. The truth is, even in countries that believe themselves to be rich, like the United States, and believe that they can transition to solar and wind and things like that, the truth is that nuclear power provides about 15% of baseload capacity in the United States. And either the uranium price goes up to a price necessary for the industry to earn its cost of capital, or the lights go out in 5 or 6 years. My suspicion is that it's the uranium price that goes up. Having said that, virtually all of the juniors, will need to refinance. They'll need to raise more equity so that they can survive until the upturn in prices takes place. For those subscribers of yours who are private placement qualified and who are sufficiently diligent to participate in the sector, I think that there are going to be private placement opportunities in the uranium sector that will rival the opportunities that I enjoyed in 2000 and 2001, which were for me the single most dramatic financial events of my life. This is not for the faint of heart. You know, you're providing survival capital to companies when the upcycle is indeterminate in terms of when it's going to start. That's precisely the circumstance that I faced in 1999, 2000, and 2001. And the amount of money that I made still makes me smile after all these years.
Rick, one final question, and sticking to the uranium topic. I've spoken to a couple pretty sophisticated investors in the space who also witnessed that brilliant uranium liftoff from 01 that lasted to 2006. And they've made the point that they're not sure there will be quite as big of a lift as there was in the past, because there is so many, so many projects now that benefited from all of that capital that was thrown in the space that can easily come back to market. Are you concerned about the ability for the space to grow from 20 to 500 companies far faster than it did last time?
I'm not concerned about that at all. Well, first of all, the market doesn't need to come back in anywhere near the quantum it did that time. That was a fictional move. At the beginning of that market, there were five uranium juniors in the world, and the poorest performer generated a 22-to-1 return over the cycle. Although I'm fairly greedy, I don't require a 22-to-1, never mind a 1,000-to-1 return to be satisfied. The second thing is that there are, as you suggest, a few people who, in fact, quite a few people who remember that move and remember it with fondness. And if you get that, if you give that group a legitimate experience to come back in the sector, I think the rapidity with which money will come back into the uranium juniors will surprise people. I'm not saying when this will occur or how it will occur. I'm just saying as the uranium price begins to firm up to a price that's necessary to maintain production, that in fact the response of money flowing into the uranium equities will surprise people. The third point, however, which is the ability to tamper the rally, is really in place. The swing producer now, which didn't exist then, was Kazakhstan. And Kazakhstan's production, at least most of their shut-in production, is in-situ recovery, or ISR. And these mines can be turned on very, very quickly. So my suspicion is that when you see $50 or $55 yellow cake, that the idea that the material will go up to 100 or 120 or 150 like it did last time is probably illusory, because I think that although the big Canadian mines and the African mines won't be able to restart, the Kazakhstan ISR mines will be able to restart very quickly, as will some U.S.-based in-situ recovery plants.
Rick, I'm going to put a link up on the screen, sprottusa.com/rankings. And yep. You used to give out your email. You now have this on an automated system. Tell our listeners what they can get by going to this nifty link here.
I'm really excited about this. Anybody who's, first of all, what you need to know is that there will be a sheet there where you can list your natural resource companies, everything that's in your portfolio. And I will rank those companies 1 to 10, 1 being best, 10 being worst. Understand that these rankings are snapshots in time. They won't be accurate a year from now, but they are accurate now. I will also comment on those companies where I think my comments might have value. Further, I will include two charts with those rankings. By the way, keeping company of that excellent chart that you sent out with regards to the TSXV resources, superb chart. Anyway, my two charts are this Barron's Gold Mining Index that I've talked about, a 45-year index of relative valuations of gold equities, and also a 100-year commodity chart, which shows just how cheap commodities are in real terms, in historic context. This is not to get your speculators all hot and bothered about the commodities market, which I think has farther to fall as a consequence of declining economic outlook. It's just to put where we are in context. So in summary, I will rank, rate, and comment on your natural resource equities portfolios. Please put names and symbols in both, not just the symbols. And I will send those two charts, the Barron's Gold Mining Index and also the 100-year commodity chart, back by return email. Please also be a bit patient. These turbulent times have made a lot of people anxious to have their portfolios ranked by an organization like Sprott.
All right. Well, Rick, thank you as always for coming back on Palisade Radio. Like I said, we have that link up on the screen for listeners, and we will do this again here in the next month or two.
Always a pleasure. I'm delighted that you're back to interviewing. I trust all is well in Puerto Rico. I trust that you've managed to stay socially distanced and safe and healthy.
Indeed. Thank you very much, Rick.
Thank you.
think you understand the junior mining sector and you think that the participants in the mining sector, junior mining sector, are good people and kind people, hit the bid.
How violent that term could be, it actually could be quite violent. It could be a rip your face off uranium rally.
And the world is always going to need raw material. It's going to need copper and gold and nickel and so forth.
Totally destabilized. Hey, troll, did you hear what's going on in Yemen?